What's the impact of sugar-sweetened and non-sugar-sweetened beverages on stroke?
How quickly should you have colonoscopy if there's blood in your stool?
Managing preeclampsia.
And making the connection between malaria resistance and multiple sclerosis.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. Posted on April 28, 2017, I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I think we should turn right to the New England Journal of Medicine because this is such a curiosity. What in the world could malaria possibly have to do with multiple sclerosis?
Well, Elizabeth, you happened to pick this particular article to talk about, and I'm glad you did. At first, I thought it was a little bit too geeky, but then as I began to explore the associations, it's really pretty fascinating. When we look at autoimmune diseases, and multiple sclerosis is one of those, where our immune system attacks our own body, we've mapped hundreds of susceptibility regions in the various genes. However, we've actually done a pretty poor job of isolating the specific gene and, more importantly, looking at the underlying mechanisms. So these authors looked at a population that has an increased risk of multiple sclerosis and lupus, and that's people from the island of Sardinia. They have one of the larger populations of centenarians, people over 100, but a markedly increased risk of autoimmune disease. And they did genome-wide analysis and discovered there's a specific gene that targets a cytokine, a protein, called a B-cell activating factor. We'll call it BAF. B cells are responsible for our immune system, what's called the humoral immunity. And with this particular variant, these individuals have a higher level of BAF. There's more immunoglobulins, things are activated, and that seems to be associated with multiple sclerosis and lupus. Well, interestingly enough, BAF, because of the increased immunity, also confers malaria resistance. And until the mid-1950s, malaria was a significant problem on the island of Sardinia. So it looks like individuals that had high BAF levels were more likely to be resistant to malaria, therefore more likely to be alive later in life, and that same immune system that protected from malaria also predisposes them to multiple sclerosis and lupus.
Really fascinating and a clear demonstration of, in my mind, evolution at work, the selection for a survival advantage relative to a certain gene. We see that also with sickle cell anemia, for example, and malaria.
So these are evolutionary advantageous changes that in excess cause other problems.
I'm also interested in the lack of an association in the Sardinian population between longevity and autoimmune disease. What I mean is, gosh, if we've got the largest population of centenarians, but they also have pretty robust autoimmune disease, then it seems to show that there's no association between autoimmune disease and increased mortality.
What it means is there's probably a sweet spot in what I'm going to call the BAF levels, where there's enough to protect you from malaria, but not so much where you get an autoimmune disease process.
Let's turn from here to the journal Stroke. I thought this was really interesting, admittedly an association, but if you drink a bunch of either sugar-sweetened or not sugar-sweetened beverages, you may increase your risk of stroke.
These authors use data from the Framingham offspring cohort. These are individuals we've been following for decades, and they analyze the relationship between recent and long-term consumption of both sugar-sweet beverages and artificially sweet beverages. Now, why did they do this? Well, because there's clearly an association between sugar-sweet beverages and metabolic syndrome, that is diabetes and hypertension, inflammatory conditions, and in some studies, an increased association with stroke as well. So they were trying to document that. So the control would be artificially sweet beverages. They queried people about what their intake was with regard to these two beverages over about a 10-year period. And what they found is for individuals that had both a higher recent and cumulative intake of artificially sweet soft drinks, it was associated with a threefold increase risk of stroke and Alzheimer's. Paradoxically, there was no increased risk with sugar sweet beverages. When you look at the two groups of individuals, those that drank the artificially sweet beverages in this particular study did in fact have a higher incidence of hypertension, obesity, and to have a higher incidence of diabetes. It may explain why it's a particular patient population and not the artificially sweetened beverage.
At least from an anecdotal perspective, admittedly the N is one, I've largely given up on all of those kinds of things, but for a long time, I drank the ones that had the artificial sweeteners because I didn't want to gain weight. and I'm not hypertensive and I don't have diabetes. And so I think there's probably a lot of people like me who are out there quaffing those things too.
That may be, but again, the nice thing about this particular study is you can compare both groups. And in this particular study, those that drank the artificially sweet beverages did in fact have more risk factors.
I think we're seeing a lot of emerging evidence regarding those kinds of beverages, whether sugar sweetened or artificially sweetened. And as far as I'm concerned, the best thing to drink is water. And I'm just going to go out on a limb and say that's my public health message for this week. Let's turn from here to the Journal of the American Medical Association. The USPSTF has released guidelines on the management of preeclampsia, that condition that arises sometimes in pregnancy and can be associated with both morbidity and mortality for both the mom and the baby.
This is a significant issue. Worldwide, as many as 8% of women develop preeclampsia, and in the United States, it's about 4%, about 1 in 25 women who are pregnant. It's a multi-system inflammatory condition that poses risk to the mother and risk to the child as well. It kind of peaks about 34 weeks of pregnancy. And we know there are risk factors, for example, being African American or having pre-existing high blood pressure or diabetes. What the USPSTF did was say, what's the appropriate screening and what's the benefit versus harm? The most effective way for screening is just taking the blood pressure. We don't need to routinely check for protein in the urine. In fact, there are some women that will have preeclampsia and not develop protein in the urine. So their recommendation is that all women for prenatal visits have blood pressure screening. And if the blood pressure is elevated, is to take it again during that same visit.
Okay, so a couple questions. One is, of course, it was my understanding that routine measurement of blood pressure always happens in prenatal visits. So I'm a little bit taken aback by the idea that somehow it's not and it needs to be recommended. That's one thing. And then the other thing is, what do we do about management if a woman's blood pressure does appear to be rising during the latter part of her pregnancy?
I thought the same thing. I kind of yawned and said, we know you ought to take blood pressure. The value of these recommendations is, first of all, they confirm that because this is an update since the 1965 guidelines. But more importantly, what they tell us is that measuring protein in the urine with a dipstick isn't particularly helpful, and we can screen all women. There are a couple recommendations. For women that are at high risk, it's recommended they take one baby aspirin a day. That lowers the risk of preeclampsia. And for women that have it, the only way to treat this for mothers is actually to deliver the baby. So if the baby has to be delivered prior to 36 weeks, you want to make sure the lungs are mature. So the mother receives steroids primarily for the baby.
Okay. Finally, then, in JAMA, a look at fecal immunochemical testing, which is increasingly common and popular with regard to colorectal cancer screening and outcomes.
As we've discussed before, and our listeners should be well aware, most colorectal cancers start as polyps. And if we detect the polyp and remove it, we lower the risk of developing colorectal cancer and lower mortality associated with that. So here's the question. If you have a positive occult blood in the stool, how quickly do you have to have the colonoscopy to either prevent cancer or to recognize it before it develops late stage disease is more difficult to treat? And that's what these authors looked at. Looked at over 70,000 patients that had a positive FIT result, and the authors examined the relationship between the time to colonoscopy from when the test was identified to be positive to the risk of having any colorectal cancer and particularly advanced stage. And here's what they found out. In these 70,000 individuals with a positive FIT test, there was no significant difference in the risk of colorectal cancer if the colonoscopy was done within the first 2 months, 3 months, 4 to 6 months, or even 7 to 9 months. However, if the follow-up was longer, there was an increased risk of colorectal cancer and an increased risk of late stage cancer. It increases it by about 50 to 100%. So the bottom message is, if it's determined to be positive, you don't have to have the colonoscopy within the next week or two. It should be done within the next 6 to 8 months, but it doesn't have to be done within the first several weeks. That should be reassuring to the patient to give them time to schedule the test when it's convenient for them and shouldn't burden the healthcare system as well.
Well, these are really practical results, and I love practical results. I'm going to, again, go out on a limb and prognosticate that I think we're going to see a whole lot more of this kind of testing for screening specifically, and I think it's going to reduce the number of colonoscopies, routine colonoscopies that are done out there in the short term.
Yeah, there are some individuals that want the most definitive test, and that would be the colonoscopy. Other people want to avoid the preparation and the discomfort and the invasive procedure, and they prefer just to be able to do the testing at home, which is what the FIT testing does. In either case, the most important thing for our listeners to realize is for individuals over the age of 55 or those younger that have a history of colorectal cancer in the family, they need to be screened with one of these techniques.
No doubt. This, of course, is a moving target, one that I've been watching with some fascination. So I think we're going to see it move further. I'm just guessing. On that note, I think I'm going to talk about the New England Journal of Medicine study, because I'm a nerd. I like those kind of things. This week on the blog, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.